That evening, Mia booked a plane ticket, the second she'd ever bought. It took most of her savings, but a bus across the country would take days. Too long. She arrived at Pauline and Mal's apartment with a knapsack slung over her shoulder and Pearl in her arms. Pauline, 20 pounds thinner, looked like a more concentrated version of herself, whittled down somehow, pared down to her essence. They spent the afternoon together, Mal and Pauline cooing over the baby, and Mia spending the night, for the first and last time, in their guest room with Pearl beside her. In the morning, she woke early to nurse Pearl on the couch in the living room, and Pauline came in. "Stay," Pauline said. Her eyes were almost feverishly bright, and Mia wanted to rise and fold Pauline into her arms. But Pauline waved her to sit and held up her camera. "Please," she said. "I want to take both of you." She took a whole roll, one exposure after another, and then Mal came out with a pot of tea and a shawl for Pauline's shoulders, and Pauline put the camera away. By the time Mia boarded the plane back to San Francisco that evening, Pearl in her arms, she had forgotten all about it. "Do what it takes," Pauline had said to her as she had hugged her goodbye. For the first time, she had kissed Mia on the cheek. "I'm expecting great things from you." Her use of the present tense, as if this were just an ordinary goodbye, as if she, Pauline, had every expectation of watching Mia's career unfurl before her over decades, penned Mia's voice in her throat. She had pulled Pauline close and breathed her in, her particular scent of lavender and eucalyptus, and turned away again before Pauline could see her cry. A week and a half later, Mal had called again. The call, Mia had known, was coming. 11 days, she thought. She had known it would happen fast, but could not quite believe that 11 days ago, Pauline had been alive. It was still warm, still June. The page on the calendar hadn't even changed. And then, a few weeks later, a package arrived in the mail. "She picked these to send to you," read the note, in Mal's angular handwriting. Inside were 10 prints, 8x10, black and white, each glowing as if lit from behind in that peculiar way of all of Pauline's work. Mia cradling Pearl in her arms. Mia lifting Pearl high above her head. Mia nursing Pearl, the fold of her blouse just concealing the pale globe of her breast. On the back of each, Pauline's unmistakable signature, and a note clipped to a business card. "Anita will sell these for you when you need money. Send her your work, when you're ready. I've told her to expect you. P." After that, Mia began to take pictures again, with a fervor that felt almost like relief. She walked the city again, for hours at a time, Pearl strapped to her back in a sling she'd fashioned from an old silk blouse. Most of her savings were gone by now, and every roll of film was precious, so she worked carefully, framing the image again and again in her mind before she took it. With each shutter click, she thought of Pauline. By the time summer came, she had 7 shots that she thought might have something, as Pauline had always put it. Anita did not wholly agree. "Promising," she wrote in response to the prints Mia sent. "But not yet. Take more risks." In response, Mia sent her the first of Pauline's photographs. "Then I need more time," she wrote. "Get me as much time for this as you can. Don't give anyone my name." Anita, after a heated auction, got Mia 2 years' worth of time, even after the 50% commission. She would make it count. It would be 15 years before, faced with Pearl's hospital bill for pneumonia, she sold another. Within a year, Mia had sent Anita another set of prints, each chronicling something slow decay, a dead cottonwood, a condemned house, a rusting car, that she was ready to take on. "Congratulations," she said to Mia when she called her a month later. "I've sold one of them, the one with a car. $400. Not a lot, but a start." Mia took it as a sign. For a while now, she had been dreaming of deserts, of cactus and wide red skies. New images were starting to form in her mind. "I'll call you in a week or two," she said, and tell you where to wire the money. Mrs. Delaney watched from the living room window as Mia packed the trunk of the rabbit, set Pearl's bassinet snugly in the footwell of the front seat. To Mia's astonishment, when she pried the house key loose from the key ring and handed it back, Mrs. Delaney pulled her into an uncharacteristic hug.
"I never told you about my daughter, did I?" she said, her voice thick.
And then, before Mia could speak, she took the key and hurried back up the front steps, the metal gate clanging shut behind her. Mia thought about this all through the long drive, until outside of Provo, where she decided to stop, the first of the many stops she and Pearl would make over the years. All the long way, Pearl cooed from her bassinet beside her, as if she were sure, even at this early age, that they were headed for great and important things. As if she could somehow see all the way across the country and through time to everything that was coming their way. 15. Mrs. Richardson, of course, could not know all of this. She could know only the basics of the story the Wrights had told her. Then Mia had shown up, belly bulging, claiming to be a surrogate for some family named Ryan. The Wrights couldn't remember their first names. "Jamie, Johnny, something like that," Mr. Wright had said. "Someone on Wall Street," she said. "Someone with a lot of money." "I wasn't sure it was true," Mrs. Wright admitted. "I thought maybe she was just in trouble, that she was lying to us. But then that lawyer called." A few weeks after Mia had left, a lawyer had phoned the Wrights, asking if they had a way to get in touch with her. "He sent us a card," Mrs. Wright remembered, "in case she ever sent us her address. But we never heard from her again." She dabbed at the corner of her eye again with a tissue. After some rummaging, Mrs. Wright found the lawyer's card, and Mrs. Richardson copied down the address. Thomas Riley. Riley and Schwartz, partners at law. A 212 area code. An address on 53rd Street. She thanked the Wrights, and when Mrs. Wright pressed some extra cookies on her, she declined, embarrassed. The Wrights offered to lend her photos of Warren in his football uniform, too. Well, maybe the paper would want to run them with the story, they'd suggested.
"As long as we get them back," Mrs. Wright added. "They're the only copies we've got."
Guilt clawed at the back of Mrs. Richardson's neck like a spider. They seemed like nice people, these Wrights. Nice people who had been through a lot. Nice people who could have been her neighbors in Shaker Heights.
"If the paper wants photos, I'll get back in touch," she said.
This, she told herself, was at least the truth.
"I'm so sorry about everything you've been through," she said at the door, and meant it.
Then she hesitated. "If you ever manage to find out where your daughter is, would you want to get in touch with her again?"
"Maybe," Mrs. Wright said.
"We've thought of hiring a detective to look for her, you know, see if we could get any leads. But it seemed to us that if she wanted to be found, she'd have gotten in touch. She knows where we live. Our phone number's the same as it's been her whole life. She must think we're still angry at her."
"Are you?"
Mrs. Richardson asked, on impulse. And neither Mr. Wright nor Mrs. Wright answered. The number of the law firm was 16 years old, but Mrs. Richardson decided it was worth a try. Back at her hotel, she dialed, and to her immense relief, a secretary picked up almost immediately. "Riley, Schwartz, and Henderson," the woman said.
"Hello," Mrs. Richardson began. "I'm calling regarding a case Mr. Riley was working on quite some time ago."
She paused, thinking quickly.
"I have some information that my client thinks may be relevant, but before I pass along any information, I wanted to be sure Mr. Riley is still representing the Ryans. As you can imagine, this information is rather sensitive."
The secretary paused. "Which case did you say you were involved with?"
"The Ryans. The information I have regards Amia Wright."
There was a sound of a drawer opening and a rustling of files. Mrs. Richardson held her breath.
"Here we are. Joseph and Madeline Ryan. Yes, Mr. Riley is still on retainer for them, though, she paused. This file hasn't been active in quite some time. But Mr. Riley is in the office currently, and I'd be happy to put you through to him. What did you say your name was?
Mrs. Richardson hung up. Her heart was pounding. Then, after several minutes of careful thought, she flipped open her address book and dialed her friend Michael, who worked at the New York Times. They'd met in college, working on the Dennisonian, and though Michael had jumped from there to the Stamford Advocate and then quickly to the news desk at the Times, while she had returned home and gone local, they had stayed in touch. He had once, she was quite sure, been in love with her, though he'd never said anything about it, and they'd both been married for years now. Recently, he'd been nominated for a Pulitzer, though he'd lost out to someone from the AP reporting on the killings in Rwanda.
"Michael," she said, "can you do me a favor?"
A week later, Michael would call back and confirm what she had already suspected. Through journalistic sleight of hand known only to himself, he had managed to find hospital bills for Amia Wright in 1981 at St. Elizabeth's in Midtown Manhattan. They had been paid for by a Joseph Ryan, and they had stopped in February 1982, when Mia would have been 6 months pregnant. And if Mrs. Richardson had had any doubts about where Pearl had come from, they would vanish. She would have to think about what, if anything, to do with this information. The poor Ryans, wanting a baby so badly that they take such steps to get one. Yes, she knew something about that, she thought, thinking of Linda and Mark McCullough. But she felt a twinge of sympathy for Mia, too, one she hadn't felt before and had never expected to feel. How excruciating it must have been to think about giving her child away. What would she have done if she'd been in that situation? Mrs. Richardson would ask herself this question over and over, before Michael's call and for weeks and months after. Each time, faced with this impossible choice, she came to the same conclusion. "I would never have let myself get into that situation," she told herself. "I would have made better choices along the way." For now, Mrs. Richardson stacked her notes in her folder, which she had discreetly labeled M.W. Tomorrow, she would drive back home. On the way out of the clinic, Lexi was having trouble processing what was happening to her, what had just happened to her. Her legs and her body trotted confidently ahead, while her head drifted along behind like a dawdling balloon. She had been pregnant, and now she was not. There had been something alive inside her, and now there was not. Deep in her belly, she felt a vague cramping and a warm, damp trickle into the thick sanitary pad the nurse had given her. The rest of the package was in her bag, along with a bottle of Advil. "You'll want this later on, when the anesthetic wears off," the nurse had told her. Pearl took her arm. "You okay?" Lexi nodded, and the parking lot spun around and landed on its side. Pearl caught her as she began to tip. "Okay. Come on. Almost there." The original plan had been to drive Lexi home. Her mother wasn't due back until tomorrow afternoon, and by then, Lexi had assumed, she would be back to normal, ready to pretend nothing had happened. But it was clear to Pearl, as she guided Lexi into the front seat of the Explorer, that Lexi was in no condition to go home. She was woozy from the anesthesia, and in the end, Pearl had to buckle the seatbelt around her. "Okay," she said. "We'll go to my house." "What about your mom?" Lexi asked. And when Pearl said, "She can keep a secret," this seemed like the saddest thing Lexi had ever heard, and she burst into tears. It was just past noon when they entered the house on Winslow, and Mia, cutting a maple tree out of a magazine ad with an X-Acto knife, looked up in alarm as they entered the kitchen. At the sight of the scalpel in Mia's hands, Lexi, who had calmed down by the end of the drive, began to cry again. To everyone's surprise, even her own, Mia pulled Lexi into her arms. "You're all right," she said. "It's all going to be okay." Lexi was never entirely sure afterward whether she had told Mia what had happened, or if Pearl had. or if Mia had simply intuited it on her own. All she would remember was Mia holding her tight, so tight that the world stopped spinning at last. Mia tucking her into a low, soft bed that, it turned out later, was Mia's own. Mia, in fact, had already had suspicions about Lexi's situation, though Brian had cautiously flushed their condoms down the toilet. A few times when Mia emptied the garbage in Lexi's room, she had found the condom wrappers balled into a wad of tissues. One afternoon, when she'd come back to the Richardson house to retrieve her purse, which she'd left behind that morning by mistake, she tripped over Brian's size 12 tennis shoes in the entryway, right beside Lexi's platform sandals. There had been no sign of the two of them, but Mia had grabbed her bag from the kitchen island and hurried out, half afraid of what she might hear from upstairs, shutting the door quietly and hoping the noise wouldn't carry. Lexi, every time Mia saw her, struck her as terrifyingly young, and Mia did not want to think about what Lexi was certainly up to, nor what, by extension, Pearl might be up to as well. So when Lexi had appeared in the doorway, half-leaning on Pearl's arm, Mia took in her wan and grayish face, the pink discharge form from the clinic still clutched in her hand, the plastic bag full of pads dangling from Pearl's wrists, and understood immediately what had happened. If someone had asked her, a month or even a week before, to guess what she might have felt, she might have anticipated a sliver of gloating, or at least a moment of holier-than-thou. In the actual moment, however, she felt nothing but a flood of deep sympathy for Lexi, for the bind she had found herself in, for the pain, both physical and emotional, she would have to fight through to get out of that bind. Lexi woke up nestled under a crisp white comforter. It was mid-afternoon and the curtains were drawn, but a lamp in the corner had been left on, a towel draped over the shade to mute it, and the thoughtfulness of this pierced her. For the third time that day, she found herself sobbing. And then Mia was there, sitting at her bedside, stroking her back. "It's okay," she said to Lexi. And though she said nothing else, just this, "It's okay. It's okay." Lexi found herself breathing easier. Mia settled herself cross-legged on the floor and handed Lexi a tissue, and Lexi realized that the bed wasn't simply low, it was a mattress set on the carpet. She blew her nose. There was no garbage can in sight, but Mia held out her hand, and after a moment of embarrassment, Lexi handed over the damp wad of tissue. "You slept a long time. That's good. Do you think you can eat something?" In the kitchen, Mia set a bowl of soup in front of her, and Lexi brought a spoonful to her lips. Chicken noodle. Salty, searingly hot. There was no sign of Pearl, but the clock on the stove read 3:15. School had let out a little while ago. She must have told her mother everything, Lexi thought. "This wasn't supposed to happen," she blurted out. She felt an intense need to explain herself, to make sure Mia did not think ill of her. At that moment, Pearl came up into the apartment. She was flushed in the face and panting a little. "I borrowed Moody's bike," she said. "Had to get home and see if you were doing okay." "You didn't," Lexi began, and Pearl shook her head. "Of course I didn't tell him," she said. "I said I forgot I promised I'd get home early to help my mom with something." It unnerved her how easy it had been to lie to Moody again, but she shook the feeling aside as if she were brushing off cobwebs. "How are you doing?" "She's going to be fine," Mia said, and patted Lexi's hand. "I'm sure of it." 10 minutes later, as Mia was setting the soup bowl into the sink to soak, another set of footsteps came thumping up the stairs, and Izzy arrived. Afternoons were her time with Mia, and she spent the last few periods of the day anticipating what Mia might be working on, thinking of things to share. At the sight of Lexi, she froze in the doorway. "What are you doing here?" Lexi scowled. "I came over to hang out with Pearl, obviously," she snapped. "You have a problem with that?" Izzy glanced from Lexi to Pearl with deep suspicion. Her sister never came to the house on Winslow. She much preferred to spend her time in the comfort of the Richardson's rec room, where where there were comfortable chairs and a big TV, and snacks and Diet Cokes were plentiful. Here, there was no TV, not even a couch. It was most unlike Lexi. Why would she and Pearl meet here rather than there? Yet there Lexi was, looking pale and uncertain and perhaps even a little red-eyed, all of which were most unlike Lexi, too. "I'm helping Lexi with her English paper," Pearl said. "We thought we'd work better over here." "It's okay, Izzy," Mia said. "But you know, since the girls are here, I'm not working today. Tomorrow, okay?" Then when Izzy hesitated, she said, "Tomorrow. I promise. After school, just like always." She gave Izzy's elbow a little squeeze as she turned her around in the doorway. And Izzy, with a glare at Lexi, clumped back down the stairs. In a moment, they heard the door slam shut behind her. "She is so pissed at me," Lexi murmured. "Well, what else is new?" Now that Izzy was gone, she felt herself drained, and she slumped backward in her chair, letting her ponytail drape over the back. Pearl eyed her. "You don't look so good." "Back to bed," Mia said calmly. "You've been through a lot today." In the bedroom, she settled Lexi onto the mattress again and spread the comforter over her and patted her back gently, as if she were a child. It was oddly soothing. "Shit," Lexi said. "The robocall. My parents will know I cut." Shaker Heights took attendance seriously. At the start of each class, a teacher filled out a scantron marking anyone absent. Back in the main office, a secretary ran the attendance sheets through a machine, and a recorded call went out to the parents' home phone, alerting them about their truant children. "I called you in," Mia said, "after you and Pearl got here. I said you weren't feeling well today, and you'd be out all day, and tomorrow." Lexi felt as if her head were made of wood. "But you need a parent to excuse you," she mumbled, pushing herself up on her forearms. The room began to wobble. "I told them I was your mother. How would they know the difference?" Mia put a hand on Lexi's shoulder and gently pushed her back down. Her voice, Lexi thought, was so calm, as if she knew how to get away with anything. "Rest," Lexi heard her say, and she was asleep almost at once. When she woke again, it was late evening. She lay in the dimness, watching the sky darken until Mia knocked on the door carrying a steaming mug of tea. "I thought you might be thirsty," she said, and Lexi accepted the cup and took a grateful sip. Peppermint. Under her fingers, the mug was comfortingly solid, like a warm, strong shoulder. "I called your father," Mia said. Her mother, Lexi remembered suddenly, was supposed to arrive home the next afternoon. "Shit," she whispered. "Did you tell him?" "I told him you were staying over here tonight, that Pearl had asked you to sleep over." After a moment, Lexi said, "Thanks." "You can stay as long as you need to, but I'm betting you'll be ready to go home tomorrow." Lexi turned the mug around slowly between her palms. "And then?" "Then it's up to you what you do. Who you tell." Mia got up to leave, but Lexi, in a panic, grabbed her hand. "Wait," she said. "Do you think I made a huge mistake?" She gulped. "Do you think I'm a terrible person?" She had never given much thought to Mia, but suddenly it felt crucial to know if Mia disapproved of her. In the face of Mia's kindness, she could not bear it if Mia disapproved of her. "Oh, Lexi." Mia sat down again, still holding Lexi's hand. "You were in a very hard situation. A situation no one wants to be in. But what if I chose wrong?" Lexi paused, closing her eyes, trying to feel that spark of life that she'd been so certain was cartwheeling inside her before. "Maybe I should have kept it. Maybe I should have told Brian. We could have made it work."
"Would you have been ready to be a good mother?" Mia asked.
The kind of mother you'd have wanted to be. The kind of mother a child deserves. They sat in silence for a few minutes, Mia's hand warm on Lexi's. Lexi felt an overwhelming urge to lean her head on Mia's shoulder, and after a moment she did. For the first time, she wondered what it would have been like to grow up as Pearl, to have Mia as her mother, to have this life as her life. And thought made her a bit dizzy. "You'll always be sad about this," Mia said softly. "But it doesn't mean you made the wrong choice. It's just something that you have to carry." She sat Lexi up gently and gave her a pat on the shoulder, then bent to pick up the empty mug. "But do you think I made the wrong choice?" Lexi persisted. She felt sure Mia would know. Mia paused, one hand on the doorknob. "I don't know, Lexi," she said. "I think you're the only one who can know that." The door closed softly behind her. When Lexi opened her eyes, it was early morning. There was no sign of anyone, but someone had turned the lamp off, and someone had set a glass of water at her bedside. Pearl was in the kitchen, eating a bowl of cereal. "You look better," she said to Lexi. "You okay?"
"Getting there."
Lexi settled herself gingerly onto the other mismatched chair opposite Pearl.
"Where's your mom?"
"At your house. She went over to clean early. She's doing lunch shift at the restaurant today." Pearl suddenly remembered Lexi's views on the McCullough case and decided not to mention the reason for the unusual schedule. Bibi was meeting with her lawyer to prepare for the hearing, which was starting in less than 2 weeks, and had asked Mia to cover for her at work. Instead, she nudged the box of cereal toward Lexi, who tipped it toward her and took a handful.
"Did she sleep on the floor?"
"With me."
"Sorry."
Pearl shrugged.
"It's okay. We're used to it.
Sometimes we don't have space for two beds." She slid a bowl across the table.
"Don't eat it out of the box. Pour some out. Freak."
Lexi seemed much younger somehow, and she couldn't tell if it was the morning light, soft and pale yellow, or Lexi herself, no makeup, hair loose around her face, or the strangeness of this moment, of Lexi breakfasting in her kitchen, of what they'd been through together the day before.
"Your mom was really nice to me last night." Lexi stirred the cereal in her bowl.
"My mom is nice," Pearl said, with a prickle of pride.
"I always thought she didn't like me."
"Well," Pearl considered. She too had had this feeling, but could sense now that something had shifted.
"I don't think you knew each other."
"You think she likes me now?" Lexi asked at last.
"Maybe," Pearl grinned.
And Lexi got up, slung an arm around her, and kissed her on the cheek. The night before, as they lay side by side in Pearl's little twin bed, Mia had reached out to rub her daughter's back, something she hadn't done in years. When Pearl had been young, they had often shared a bed. It was easier to find one mattress than two, of course. But there had also been an intense comfort in being close together, like small animals sheltered deep in their den. As Pearl had grown taller, sharing a bed became less and less feasible, and it had been a long time since they'd lain together this way.
"Poor Lexi," Mia murmured. "Such a hard place to be in." There was something she felt she needed to say, but she wasn't sure how.
And after a moment, she simply plunged in.
"Are you...
do you..." She paused.
"We've never really had this talk before."
Pearl pulled away and flopped abruptly onto her back.
"Oh my God, Mom, let's not do this." "I just want to make sure you know how to be careful."
Mia rubbed a scratch on her thumbnail. She'd nicked it the day before, working on something.
"I know you and Moody are very close."
Beside her, she felt Pearl's whole body go very still, then, just as suddenly, relax again.
"Mom," Pearl said, "Moody and I are just friends." "But maybe someday you'll want to be more. I know how it goes.
Mia stopped.
She didn't, she realized suddenly. She didn't know how it went. Not at all. As a teenager, she'd had plenty of friends, some of them boys, but none as close as the friendship between her daughter and Moody seemed to be. They were together constantly, it seemed. They finished each other's sentences. They talked in a patois of inside jokes and shared references that sometimes she barely understood. More than once, she'd seen Pearl lean over carelessly to fix Moody's collar. Just the other day, she'd seen Moody reach out to pluck a wayward leaf from Pearl's hair with such tenderness that she could call it nothing other than love. But she herself had never felt that way about anyone. Not as a teenager, not in art school, not since. It occurred to her that except for her brother, when they were children, she'd never seen a man naked. More than that, she'd never touched anyone and felt that warmth, that electric tension at the nearness of someone else. The only thing that had given her that feeling had been art, and then, of course, Pearl. She had nothing useful to say about this, she thought, and the silence billowed out between them.
Mom? In the dark, Mia couldn't tell if Pearl was serious or smiling.
You don't need to worry. I promise. There's nothing between Moody and me.
She rolled over onto her side, away from Mia, the pillow now muffling her voice.
And I got an A in health class. I know all this stuff.
It was the truth, she told herself. Not a single word she'd said had been a lie.
Omission, Pearl decided, was not the same as lying.
She felt Mia begin to rub her back again. The same gentle caress that, as a child, had told her she was not alone, that her mother was there, which meant that everything was all right. As it had all those years ago, it put her to sleep almost at once. After Pearl had begun to snore softly, Mia kept her hand in place, as if she were a sculptor shaping Pearl's shoulder blades. She could feel Pearl's heart ever so faintly beating under her palm. It had been a long time since her daughter had let her be so close. Parents, she thought, learned to survive touching their children less and less. As a baby, Pearl had clung to her. She'd worn Pearl in a sling because whenever she'd set her down, Pearl would cry. There'd scarcely been a moment in the day when they had not been pressed together. As she got older, Pearl would still cling to her mother's leg, then her waist, then her hand, as if there were something in her mother she needed to absorb through the skin. Even when she had her own bed, she would often crawl into Mia's in the middle of the night and burrow under the old patchwork quilt. And in the morning, they would wake up tangled, Mia's arm pinned beneath Pearl's head, or Pearl's legs thrown across Mia's belly. Now, as a teenager, Pearl's caresses had become rare. A peck on the cheek, a one-armed, half-hearted hug, and all the more precious because of that. It was the way of things, Mia thought to herself. But how hard it was. The occasional embrace, a head lean for just a moment on your shoulder, when what you really wanted more than anything was to press them to you and hold them so tight you fused together and could never be taken apart. It was like training yourself to live on the smell of an apple alone, when what you really wanted was to devour it, to sink your teeth into it and consume it, seeds, core, and all. After Pearl went to school, Lexi stayed at the house on Winslow all morning. She lay across the bed and drifted off to sleep, and was still asleep when Mia came home from the restaurant with two foam containers of leftover noodles and a new idea. When the phone rang at 2 o'clock, waking Lexi at last, Mia was back at the table sketching with a pencil on a scratched piece of paper.
I know, baby, Mia was saying into the receiver as Lexi came into the living room. But you can't let it get to you. The hearing is going to be even worse. This is only the tip of the iceberg.
She glanced at Lexi, then turned back to the phone.
It's going to be okay. Take a deep breath.
I'll call you later.
Was that Mirabelle's mother? Lexi asked when Mia had hung up the phone.
To her embarrassment, she could not remember the baby's birth name.
She's a friend of mine. Mia settled herself back at the table, and Lexi pulled up a chair alongside her. There was an article today in the paper that said some unkind things about her. It suggested she was an unfit mother. She glanced at Lexi. Maybe you knew that already, with your father representing the McCulloughs, of course. Lexi flushed. Her father had been very busy lately, staying late at his office in preparation for the hearing, which was fast approaching. But she had been too preoccupied with Brian, with college, with a visit to the clinic and everything leading up to it to pay much attention. I didn't know anything, she said stiffly. Then, is she? An unfit mother, I mean. Mia picked up her pencil and turned to her sketch again. A net, Lexi thought. No, perhaps it was a cage. Was she before? Maybe. She was in a bad situation. But she abandoned her baby. This was something Lexi had heard her mother say enough times, into the telephone to Mrs. McCullough any time the case came up, to engrave it in her mind as fact. I think she was trying to do what was best for the baby. She knew she couldn't handle things. Mia scribbled a hasty note in the corner of her drawing. The question is whether things are still the same, whether she should get another chance. And do you think she should? Mia did not answer for a moment. Then she said, most of the time, everyone deserves more than one chance. We all do things we regret now and then. You just have to carry them with you. Lexi fell silent. Unconsciously, one hand crept down to her belly, where an ache was beginning to blossom. I better go home, she said at last. School's almost over, and my mom will probably be back now. Mia swept crumbs of eraser dust from the table and stood up. Are you ready? She said, with a gentleness that made Lexi ache. No, Lexi said. She laughed nervously. But am I ever going to be? She stood up. Thanks for... Well, thanks. Are you going to tell her? Mia asked, as Lexi gathered her things. Lexi considered. I don't know, she said at last. Maybe. Not now. But maybe one day. She pulled her car keys from her pocket and lifted her purse. Beneath it was the pink discharge slip from the clinic. She paused, then crumpled it into a wad and tossed it into the garbage can. And then she was gone. 16. Mia was right. By the time the custody hearing began, there had been a series of news stories, in print and on television, on Bibi Chow and her fitness to be a mother. Some of them portrayed her as a hard-working immigrant who had come in search of opportunity and had been overcome temporarily, her supporters insisted, by the obstacles and the odds. Others were less kind. She was unstable, unreliable, an example of the worst kind of mother. The last week of March, as the hearing began, the steps to the courthouse were crowded with journalists and tabloid reporters alike, all rabid for scraps of anything that emerged in the testimony. Because the hearing was kept private, like all proceedings in family court, the news stories could continue to be sensational and simplistic, easy arguments for one side or the other. Only those in the hearing room, the McCulloughs, their lawyer, Mr. Richardson, Ed Lim, Bibi, and the judge himself, heard about all that had happened, in all its messy complexity. And it was complicated, what had happened. It was a terribly awkward, agonizingly slow, painfully intimate story that unfolded over the course of that week, back and forth between Mr. Richardson and Ed Lim, one of them making a point for his client, the other expertly picking it up and turning it neatly on its head. When the baby was found, she had been undernourished. Her fontanelle was sunken in, a telltale sign of dehydration, and her ribs and the small bones of her spine had been visible under her skin, like a string of beads. At 2 months old, she had weighed only 8 pounds. But the baby had refused to latch. Baby had tried and tried until her nipples cracked and bled. She had cried, her breasts hard with milk she could not feed her child. The infant screaming on her lap, furiously turning her little face away. And at the sound of the baby's cries, pink milk had gushed from her breasts and trickled down into her lap. After 2 weeks of this, Bibi's milk had dried up. She had spent her last $7 on formula, and then her wallet was empty, except for a fake $1 million bill someone had given her at work, for good luck. Severe diaper rash on the baby indicated that she had sat in soiled diapers for hours, if not days, on end. But Bibi had had no money for diapers. Remember that she had spent her last $7 on formula. She had done her best. She had taken the soiled diapers off, scraped them as clean as she could, refastened them around her daughter's waist. She had smeared Vaseline, the only thing she had, onto the angry red patches that blossomed on her daughter's buttocks. Neighbors had heard the baby squalling for hours on end. "All day, all night," the neighbor from 3B had said. "Screaming when I left for work in the morning. Screaming when I came home at night." He had thought about calling the police, but didn't want to interfere. "I keep to my own business." But Bibi had cried, too. Yes, she had lain and sobbed, sometimes with a baby across her chest, frantically stroking her back and hair, sometimes alone, on the floor beside the dresser drawer she had used as a cradle, while the baby wailed alongside her, their voices floating to the roof in painful harmony. In her month and a half of turbulent motherhood, Bibi did not once seek help from a psychologist or a doctor. She should have. It is true. But she had no idea where to turn. Her English was middling at best, her reading comprehension minimal. She did not know how to find the social workers who might have helped her. She did not even know they existed. She did not know how to file for welfare. She did not know that welfare was a possibility. When she looked down, she saw no safety net, only a forest of skyscrapers stabbing upward like needles upon which she would be impaled. Could you blame her for tucking her daughter onto a safe ledge while she herself plummeted? Bibi had left her baby early in the morning on January 5, 1997, at the fire station on Kinsman Road. That night, the temperature had dipped to 31 degrees. With wind chill, it was 17. At 2:30 a.m., when the firemen opened the door and discovered the baby lying in a cardboard box, it had just begun to snow, and everything was covered with a silvery, crystalline dusting. Although it had indeed been quite cold when Bibi placed her baby on the steps of the fire station, the baby had been wearing 3 shirts and 2 pairs of pants, and had been swaddled in 4 blankets, every baby item Bibi had owned. Her little hands had been tucked inside to keep them warm, and a fold of blanket had been drawn over her head to shield it from the wind. By everyone's best estimates, she had been outside for approximately 20 minutes when the fire chief opened the door, and in the snow for perhaps 2. Only a little of the snow had begun to stick to the blankets, making her look as if she had been sugared or dipped in diamonds. Bibi had been in the country only 2 years by the time her baby was born, and in Cleveland for barely 1. She had held 3 apartments in the time she had been in Cleveland, had broken the lease on 1 and had been chronically late and short on rent on another, and had never held a job that paid more than minimum wage. She had been embarrassed every month about being behind. 1 month she had paid in full, and then hadn't had enough money for groceries and electricity. What a thing, to choose between hunger and darkness. After that, she had decided to pay what she could, and on days when she got good tips, she would write her name on a piece of paper, fold a 20 inside, and slide it under her landlord's door. She kept track of the balance on an old envelope that was always out on the kitchen counter. The balance ran like this. September, $100 short. September 8th, paid $20. September 13th, paid $20. September 18th,
paid $20. October, $80 short. So now, $120 short. October 3rd, paid $20. October 14th, paid $20. October 26th, paid $20. November, $70 short. So now, $130 short. Once she was behind, how could she catch up? And what other kind of job could she get, speaking little English, having not even the equivalent of a GED? During her pregnancy, and until shortly before she had left her baby, Bibi had worked at a restaurant where one of the cooks had been arrested for dealing heroin. Prior to that time, several of the other staff members had suspected something between the two of them. There had been flirting. On at least one occasion, the cook in question had given Bibi a ride home at the end of the night. Was it not probable that Bibi, with such dubious associates, had also been involved in something illicit? The cook, Vinny, had indeed been dealing heroin. This cannot be denied. But his interest in Bibi had been purely platonic. He had pitied her, watching her belly swell, knowing that her rat of a boyfriend had taken off and left her high and dry. 10 months earlier, his sister had been in the same boat, and every night, when he came home to the apartment they shared with their mother, Teresa looked grayer, the baby squalling across her lap or slumped on her shoulder like a little old man. The two of them there on the couch looking elderly and exhausted. Is it any wonder that every morning when he saw Bibi, his heart would feel bruised? Was it wrong for him to joke with her, trying to make her smile as he could no longer make his sister smile? To give her a ride home when he saw her feet swelling until the laces of her shoes nearly split. As for Bibi, she had found Vinny attractive, it is true, but her attraction came largely from his kindness to her, and the thought of a man, any man, touching her as the baby drummed her heels within filled her with repulsion. When Vinny was picked up by the cops, Bibi had felt a deep sadness for him, as if he had been a brother she would never see again. Bibi's current job as a waitress paid her the state minimum for tipped employees, $2.35 per hour. At 50 hours per week plus tips, her average take-home pay each month was $317.50. Could she reasonably hope to support a child and provide all its necessities on that income? Would she not be forced to seek welfare and food stamps and school lunches? Would she and her child not become a drain on the community's resources? But there would be love, too. So much love. With that, you could get by with so little. It was enough for the basics. Rent, food, clothes. How did you weigh a mother's love against the cost of raising a child? Mark and Linda McCullough, it was quite clear, had all the necessary resources for raising a child. Mr. McCullough had a steady, well-paying job. Mrs. McCullough had, for the past 14 months, been a full-time mother to the baby and planned to be so indefinitely. They owned their own home in a safe, affluent neighborhood. Overall, they were in the 96th percentile financially. While in their care, the baby had been well-clothed, well-fed, and well-cared for. She had had regular medical checkups, plenty of socialization, and plenty of enrichment. Library story time, infant swim, Mommy and Me music classes. The McCullough home had been rigorously checked and certified as lead-free. Furthermore, the McCulloughs had shown themselves to be exceptionally devoted to raising a child. Records showed that they had tried to conceive children of their own for 10 years and had been waiting to adopt for another 4. They had sought the advice of every medical expert in the greater Cleveland area, including the best fertility doctors at the Cleveland Clinic, and then engaged the most reputable adoption agency in the state. Did this not suggest that they would give the baby the most loving possible care, along with every opportunity? But the baby already had a mother, whose blood flowed in her veins, who had carried her in her womb for months, who had felt her kicking and flipping within, who had labored for 21 hours as she made her way face up and screaming into the bright light of the delivery room. who had burst into ecstatic tears at hearing her child's voice for the first time, who had, even before the nurses had wiped the baby clean, even before they had cut the cord, touched every part of her child, her tiny flaring nostrils and the faint shadows of her eyebrows and the womb-slicked soles of her feet, making certain she was wholly present, learning her by heart. Should custody be returned to Bibi, she would, of course, be raising her child as a single working mother. Who would care for her child while she was at work? Would not the child be better off in a home with two parents, one of whom did not work and would be home raising her full time, rather than in a daycare for the majority of the day? And would not the child be better off in a home with a mother and a father? Studies showing the importance of a strong male figure in a child's life? It came, over and over, down to this. What made someone a mother? Was it biology alone? Or was it love? Back in the courtroom, Mr. Richardson was grateful that no one heard the last day, when Mrs. McCullough had been called to speak. She had come to the front. In family court, there was no witness box, just a chair set to the side of the judge, and sat down. And he could see how nervous she was by the way she crossed and uncrossed her ankles, by the way she could not decide where to place her hands, on the arms of the chair or in the soft hammock of her skirt. It had not struck him before that the witness box in court, for all its formality and imposingness, hid you from the waist down, that at least the world would not see your feet fidgeting, that as much as you might be judged, at least your legs would not. Ed Lim took his time in rising to question her. He was a tall man, especially for an Asian. 6 feet, lean and rangy, with the build of a basketball player. And indeed, he had played starting forward for Shaker's varsity team back in the 60s. He and Mrs. McCullough had been only 3 years apart at school, lifelong Shaker residents and graduates. And before this case, he had remembered her only as a shy, slightly plump freshman with long golden brown hair. He'd been one of just two Asians in his class. The other had been Susie Chang. Kids had teased that they would grow up and marry each other. They hadn't, of course. Susie had gone off to Oregon right after graduation. But in the end, Ed had indeed met and married a nice Chinese girl in college. A first-generation kid like him. Mrs. McCullough, however, remembered none of this, not even Susie Chang, who'd been a cheerleader for a year alongside her. "Now, Mrs. McCullough," Ed Lim said, setting his pen down at his table, "you've spent all your life here in Shaker, is that right?" Mrs. McCullough acknowledged that it was. "Shaker Heights High School, class of 1971. Did you go to Shaker schools all the way up?" "Well, from kindergarten. At Boulevard, back when it was still K-8, and then the high school, of course."
"And then you attended Ohio University?"
"Yes, class of 1975.
"And after that, you moved back to Shaker Heights, directly?"
"Yes, I'd been offered a job here, and my husband, my fiancé at the time, and I knew we wanted to raise a family here." She shot Mr. Richardson a quick glance at his table, and he gave her the merest nod. They talked about this in prep. The focus was to remind the judge, whenever possible, of how much she and Mr. McCullough wanted this baby, how family-focused they were, how devoted they were to little Mirabelle.
"So you've really lived in Ohio your entire life," Ed Lim seated himself on the arm of his chair. "Mailing's parents, as we all know by now, came from Guangdong, or perhaps you know it as Canton. Have you ever been there?" Mrs. McCullough shifted in her seat.
"Well, of course, we plan to take Mirabelle there on a heritage trip, when she's a bit older."
"Do you speak Cantonese?"
Mrs. McCullough shook her head.
"Mandarin? Shanghainese? Toisan? Any dialect of Chinese?"
Mr. Richardson clicked his pen irritably. Ed Lim was just showing off now, he thought.
"Have you studied Chinese culture at all?" Ed Lim asked. "Chinese history?"
"Of course we're going to learn all about that," Mrs. McCullough said.
It's very important to us that Mirabel stay connected to her birth culture. But we think the most important thing is that she has a loving home with two loving parents. She glanced at Mr. Richardson again, pleased that she had managed to work this in. There are two of you, he had said. That might be a big advantage over a single mother. You and Mr. McCullough are clearly very loving. I don't think anyone has any doubts about that. Edlam smiled at Mrs. McCullough, and Mr. Richardson stiffened in his seat. He knew enough about lawyers to know when they were about to snap the trap shut. Now, what exactly will you do to keep Mei Ling connected to her birth culture, as you put it? There was a long pause. Maybe that's too big of a question. Let's back up. Mei Ling has been with you for 14 months now. What have you done in the time she's been with you to connect her to her Chinese culture? Well, another pause. A very long one this time. Mr. Richardson willed Mrs. McCullough to say something, anything. Pearl of the Orient is one of our very favorite restaurants. We try to take her there once a month. I think it's good for her to hear some Chinese, to get it into her ears, to grow up feeling this is natural. And of course, I'm sure she'll love the food once she's older. Yawning silence in the courtroom. Mrs. McCullough felt the need to fill it. Perhaps we could take a Chinese cooking class at the rec center and learn together when she's older. Edlam said nothing, and Mrs. McCullough prattled nervously on. We try to be very sensitive to these issues wherever we can. Inspiration arrived. Like for her first birthday, we wanted to get her a teddy bear, one she could keep as an heirloom. There was a brown bear, a polar bear, and a panda, and we thought about it and decided on the panda. We thought perhaps she'd feel more of a connection to it. Does Mei Ling have any dolls? Edlam asked. Of course. Too many, Mrs. McCullough giggled. She loves them, just like every little girl. We buy her dolls, and my sisters buy her dolls, and our friends buy her dolls. She giggled again, and Mr. Richardson's jaw tensed. She must have a dozen or more. And what do they look like, these dolls? Edlam persisted. What do they look like? Mrs. McCullough's brow crinkled. They're dolls. Some are babies and some are little girls. It was clear she didn't understand the question. Some of them take bottles, and some of them, you can change their dresses, and one of them closes her eyes when you lay her down, and most of them, you can style their hair. And what color hair do they have? Mrs. McCullough thought for a moment. Well, blonde, most of them. One has brown hair? Maybe two. How about the doll that closes her eyes? What color are her eyes? Blue, Mrs. McCullough crossed her legs, then uncrossed them again. But that doesn't mean anything. You look at the toy aisle, most dolls are blonde with blue eyes. I mean, that's just the default. The default, Edlam repeated. And Mrs. McCullough had the feeling of being caught out, though she wasn't sure why. It's not anything racist, she insisted. They just want to make a generic little girl. You know, one that will appeal to everyone. But it doesn't look like everyone, does it? It doesn't look like Mei Ling. Edlin stood up, suddenly towering over the courtroom. Does Mei Ling have any Asian dolls? That is, any dolls that look like her? No, but when she gets older and she's ready, we can buy her a Chinese Barbie. Have you ever seen a Chinese Barbie? Edlam asked. Mrs. McCullough flushed. Well, I've never gone looking for one, yet, but there must be one. There isn't one. Mattel doesn't make one. Edlam's daughter, Monique, was a junior now. But as she'd grown up, he and his wife had noticed with dismay that there were no dolls that looked like her. At 10, Monique had begun poring over a mail-order doll catalog as if it were a book. Expensive dolls with names and stories and historical outfits. Absurdly detailed and even more absurdly expensive. Jenny Cohen has this one, she told them,
her finger tracing the outline of a blonde doll that did indeed resemble Jenny Cohen. Sweet-faced, with heavy bangs, slightly stocky.
And they just made a new one with red hair.
Her mom's getting it for her sister Sarah for Hanukkah. Sarah Cohen had flaming red hair, the color of a penny in the summer sun. But there was no doll with black hair, let alone a face that looked anything like Monique's. Ed Lim had gone to 4 different toy stores searching for a Chinese doll. He would have bought it for his daughter, whatever the price, but no such thing existed. He'd gone so far as to write to Mattel, asking them if there was a Chinese Barbie doll, and they'd replied that yes, they offered Oriental Barbie, and sent him a pamphlet. He had looked at that pamphlet for a long time, at the Barbie's strange mishmash of a costume, all red and gold satin and like nothing he'd ever seen on a Chinese or Japanese or Korean woman, at her waist-length black hair and slanted eyes. "I am from Hong Kong," the pamphlet ran. "It is in the Orient, or Far East. Throughout the Orient, people shop at outdoor marketplaces where goods such as fish, vegetables, silk, and spices are openly displayed." The year before, he and his wife and Monique had gone on a trip to Hong Kong, which struck him mostly as a pincushion of gleaming skyscrapers. In a giant, glassed-in shopping mall, he'd bought a dove-gray cashmere sweater that he wore under his suit jacket on chilly days.
"Come visit the Orient. I know you will find it exotic and interesting."
In the end, he'd thrown the pamphlet away. He'd heard from friends with younger children that the expensive doll line now had 1 Asian doll for sale, and a few black ones, too. But he'd never seen it. Monique was 17 now, and had long outgrown dolls. Now, back in the courtroom, Ed Lim paced a few steps.
"How about books? What kind of books do you read with Mei Ling?"
"Well," Mrs. McCullough began to think,
"we read her a lot of classics. Goodnight Moon, of course, and Pat the Bunny, she loves that. Madeline, Eloise, Blueberries for Sal. I saved all my favorites from when I was a child, and it's very special to get to share them with Mirabeau."
"Do you have any books that feature Chinese characters?" Mrs. McCullough was ready for this one.
"Yes, in fact, we do. We have The 5 Chinese Brothers. It's a beautiful retelling of a famous Chinese folktale."
"I know that book," Ed Lim smiled again, and Mr. Richardson's shoulders grew tight. Whenever Ed Lim smiled, he was learning you had to watch out.
"You just can't tell what he's really thinking," Mr. Richardson thought, and then instantly chagrined. "What a terrible thing to think." He flushed.
"What do those 5 Chinese brothers in the book look like?" Ed Lim was asking.
They're drawings. They all look alike. I mean, a lot like each other. They're brothers. That's part of the story. No one can tell them apart."
Mrs. McCullough fumbled.
"They have pigtails, don't they? And little coolie hats, slanty eyes."
Ed Lim didn't wait for Mrs. McCullough to respond. His daughter had seen this book in the school library in 2nd grade and returned home deeply troubled.
"Daddy, do my eyes look like that?"
"Not exactly the image of Chinese people I'd want Mei Ling to have in 1998. What about you?"
"It's a very old story," Mrs. McCullough insisted. "They're wearing traditional costume."
"How about other books, Mrs. McCullough? Any other books with Chinese characters?"
Mrs. McCullough bit her lip. "I haven't really looked for them," she admitted. "I hadn't thought about it."
"I can save you some time," said Ed Lim. "There really aren't very many. So Mei Ling has no dolls that look like her, and no books with pictures of people that look like her." Ed Lim paced a few more steps. Nearly 2 decades later, others would raise this question, would talk about books as mirrors and windows, and Ed Lim, tired by then, would find himself as frustrated as he was grateful. "We've always known," he would think. "What took you so long?" Now in the courtroom, Ed Lim stopped in front of Mrs. McCullough's chair.
You and your husband don't speak Chinese or know much about Chinese culture or history. You haven't, by your own testimony, even thought about that entire aspect of Mei Ling's identity. Isn't it fair to say that if Mei Ling stays with you and Mr. McCullough, she will effectively be divorced from her birth culture? At this point, Mrs. McCullough burst into tears. In those early weeks, she had fed Mirabel every 4 hours, held her every time she cried, and watched her grow until her heels stretched her newborn rompers almost to the breaking point. It was she who had checked Mirabel's weight regularly, who steamed peas and sweet potatoes and fresh spinach and pureed them and fed them to Mirabel in doll-sized spoonfuls. When Mirabel spiked a fever, it was she who spread a cold washcloth on her forehead, who pressed her lips to that little brow to test the heat. And when an ear infection turned out to be the culprit, it was she who fed antibiotic syrup drop by drop into Mirabel's small pink mouth and let her lap it up like a kitten. She could not, she had thought, as she bent to kiss the baby's flushed cheek, have loved this child more if it had come from her own flesh. All night, because feverish Mirabel would not sleep except in motion, she cradled Mirabel in her arms and paced the length of the room. By morning, she had walked nearly 4 miles. It was she who, after breakfast, before bath time and at bed, nuzzled Mirabel's soft belly until the baby gurgled with laughter. She was the one who had caught Mirabel in her arms as she stumbled to stand upright. She was the one to whom Mirabel stretched out her own arms when she was in pain, or afraid, or lonely. She would know Mirabel in pitch dark by one cry of her voice. No, one touch of her hand. No, one breath of her smell. "It's not a requirement," she insisted now. "It's not a requirement that we be experts in Chinese culture. The only requirement is that we love Mirabel, and we do. We want to give her a better life." She continued to cry, and the judge dismissed her. "It's all right," Mr. Richardson said as she took her place beside him. "You did just fine." Inside, however, even he was beginning to feel a faint tremor of doubt. Of course Mirabel would have a good life with Mark and Linda. There was no question about that. But would there be something missing from her life if she were to grow up with them? Mr. Richardson was suddenly keenly conscious of Mirabel, of the immense weight of the complicated world on this one tiny, vulnerable person. On the courthouse steps, when the reporters stopped them, he made a brief, anodyne statement about having faith in the process. "I have complete confidence in Judge Reinbeck that he'll weigh all the issues and make a fair decision," he said. The McCulloughs did not appear to notice this subtle shift in his tone. In earlier statements, he'd spoken with some force about how clear it was that they should receive custody, how obvious it was that they would raise her best, how completely evident it was that Mirabel belonged.